Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Mark Colvin. Among our stories tonight, the decision to expel an Israeli diplomat over the use of forged Australian passports causes a blow-up in government-opposition relations. And after the red shirt crackdown comes the roundup. A 30-year-old Irish-Australian man arrested in Bangkok. He roused the crowds with speeches during the weeks of revolt.
I would like to ask the Thai soldiers, do you come from Thai mothers? Do you have Thai sisters? I saw you shoot into Thai mothers, Thai sisters, Thai uncles.
Connor Purcell, and we'll hear from our correspondent who's at the jail where he's being held a little later in the program. First, though, there's a lot of heat but very little light in the debate on the mining super profits tax as the government and opposition argue over competing reports about how much tax the industry pays now. Name-calling and accusations dominated the day. The head of Fortescue Metals called the tax socialist-style funding. The government said the opposition was in the pocket of the mining industry. The coalition believes the proposed tax has triggered a change of mood in the electorate in its favour. Chief political correspondent Lyndall Curtis.
The Prime Minister had one message he wanted to get out, and he did so at the start of a number of his answers in Parliament today.
He used the revenues which would come from that reform to fund better super for all Australians, better tax cuts for all Australian businesses, and the benefits to which that reform would be put. Better super for working Australians, less tax for Australians.
It's a core element of the government's tax reform plans for better super for working families, lower tax for small business, and of course investing in infrastructure.
Leaving it to the Resources Minister, Martin Ferguson, to make the most cogent argument from the government side today.
The royalties framework is bad for business and even potentially worse for the Australian community. During difficult times, let's be frank, it has and it could continue to send companies to the wall.
Member for Cowan.
And in good times such as over recent years, the community misses out on the benefits of the boom because royalties remain fixed.
The rest of the debate pretty much descended into accusation, with the government accusing the opposition of being beholden to the mining industry.
I would suggest the Leader of the Opposition acquaints himself with economic fact rather than simply acting as the puppet of the MCA in this place.
What we've got is an opposition that has sold out lock, stock and barrel to some sections of the mining industry because it's more focused on a return to its own pockets in the form of donations. Order.
The opposition was launching its own broadsides at the government. Frontbencher Barnaby Joyce echoed the statement of Fortescue Mining head Andrew Forrest that the tax dropped on the Australian people is socialist-style funding.
At a federal level, what they're doing is not so much changing the tax system as nationalising the mining industry. And this is sort of the nutty stuff that you read about in Pravda. It's not the stuff we're supposed to be doing in Australia.
Western Australian backbencher Wilson Tuckey had the head of Treasury, Ken Henry, in his sights.
To say someone lies is a defamation. I'm saying he deliberately misrepresents the figures, he deliberately constructs the figures, and who was it that said, you know, lies, damn lies, and statistics?
And the opposition leader, Tony Abbott, was taking aim at the Prime Minister.
I think that what Kevin Rudd has done is verging on the unconscionable. I mean, this is a Prime Minister who has seriously put at risk the whole future of our prosperity. And this is why it would not just be good to change this government, it is in fact necessary to change this government.
Mr. Abbott went further in his comments to the coalition party room. He said the government had launched an almost criminal attack on the resources sector and that had triggered a change of mood in the electorate. He argued voters now think it's necessary to change the government. However, his comments were tempered by remarks from the Deputy Liberal leader, Julie Bishop, who told MPs the coalition is on probation and people are not yet at the point where they could be satisfied they could vote for it. The Nationals leader, Warren Truss, concurred, saying it's up to the coalition to reassure the public that the opposition is a safe pair of hands, indicating that argument hasn't been won yet. There was also a warning from one MP that the coalition needs to have an impressive policy on health because they say it will be an important issue. And another MP expressed their opposition to Mr. Abbott's paid parental leave policy. Although Mr. Abbott told the meeting the coalition has to demonstrate it's moved on from the Howard era, telling the MPs that while he was as conservative as anyone in the room, true conservatives move with the times, and the coalition isn't going to be an action replay of the Howard government. In his party room, the Prime Minister was rallying his troops, calling the opposition erratic and extreme, and saying Mr Abbott has shown he's not up to the pressure of being Prime Minister. On the issue of the day, the Treasurer got just four questions on the mining tax from MPs and told them that in all of the private discussions, such as the consultations with Treasury, mining companies had accepted they could and should pay more tax. And he said as much in Parliament.
Even the mining industry accepts that there's a case to increase the charge for the underlying value of those resources that are 100% owned by the Australian people.
No MP apparently raised questions about the electoral impact of the tax, especially in the two states Labor is hoping it may pick up seats, Queensland and Western Australia, although there is some concern in the caucus about the impact, particularly the strong opposition to the tax in the West. The political debate at the moment is stuck in the morass of competing reports on tax rates faced by miners and the economic impact of the tax and competing endorsements of positions from third parties. The only way it ends is if a deal is done between the government and the mining companies, but the government's not there yet. The final round of consultations on the tax aren't due to begin until the middle of next year, well after the next election. The government may well want to move a lot faster than that.
Lyndall Curtis. The decision to expel an Israeli diplomat over the use of forged Australian passports has also caused a blow-up in government-opposition relations. The federal government is furious with the opposition's foreign affairs spokeswoman, Julie Bishop. It says she accepted a security briefing on the expulsion, but ignored what she was told to accuse the government of base political motives. The Foreign Minister, Stephen Smith, says he's shocked by her statements and that Ms Bishop is not fit to occupy a position of trust. But today, Ms Bishop says she believes Australian agencies may have forged passports in the past to do their work. From Canberra, Sabra Lane reports.
When the Foreign Minister, Stephen Smith, announced the decision to expel an Israeli diplomat, he says the opposition leader and the opposition's foreign affairs spokeswoman, Julie Bishop, were both given briefings about it, including an insight into the evidence gathered by intelligence agencies, but not made public. This is what Ms Bishop said after her briefing yesterday about the forgeries.
There is no actual proof that the Israeli government was involved. There is an assumption. And in the absence of actual proof, I believe that the expulsion of a diplomat is either an overreaction or a calculated political decision.
Ms Bishop went on to say she believed the government's expulsion decision was made to carry favour with the Arab community as part of its campaign to win a seat on the UN Security Council. The opposition foreign affairs spokeswoman says it would have been more appropriate to reprimand or chastise Israel. Today in Parliament, the Foreign Minister, Stephen Smith, claimed he was shocked by Ms Bishop's response.
When she received the briefing from the national security agencies, as did the government, none of those national security agencies had in their mind, when they were carefully weighting their advice to the government, none of them had in their minds what she would describe as political considerations or the United Nations Security Council. They had in their minds, as did the government, the integrity of our passport system, the protection of our national security interests. And what you have done in your response yesterday and today has shown that you are not fit. The Deputy Leader of the Opposition has shown that she is not fit to occupy a position of trust in the national security environment. That's what she's shown.
This afternoon, Fairfax's Tim Lester asked Ms Bishop to explain her view that she believes the government's decision to expel an Israeli diplomat is an overreaction.
But it would be naive to think that Israel is the only country in the world that has used forged passports, including Australian passports, for security operations.
What we do?
Yes.
We use, our intelligence agencies forge passports for use in foreign operations.
Our Australian passports have been used, I said, Australian passports have been used by other countries. Has Australia forged passports before? You'll have to ask the Foreign Minister.
What do you think? I mean, you've been in government before, you'd have a fair clue of these things.
I believe that it has occurred, but I wasn't the Foreign Minister at the time.
A clearly annoyed Prime Minister responded to Ms Bishop's comments late today.
There is a long-standing convention in Australian politics that because of significant national security reasons, that neither side of politics speculates on or comments on the operation of our intelligence agencies. Today, that convention has been breached, and this is fundamentally contrary to to Australia's national security interests.
Ms Bishop issued a statement a short time ago saying she has no knowledge of any Australian authority forging any passports of any nation, and that her responses to the Fairfax interview referred to the fact that forged Australian passports have been previously used, something she says Mr Smith has acknowledged.
Sabra Lane. Yesterday we reported on a story in the British Guardian which used previously secret South African documents to say that Israel offered to sell nuclear weapons to the apartheid regime in the 1970s. That report has received a flat denial from the Israeli president Shimon Peres. He was Israel's defence minister in 1975 at the time the alleged negotiations took place. Our Middle East correspondent Ben Knight joins me now. So what has President Peres had to say?
Well, Mark, what he's had to say is that, as you say, it's a flat denial. It's an emphatic denial. It's an angry denial. There will be a harsh letter written to the Guardian newspaper. But apart from that, the point that President Peres makes is that there is no smoking gun, if you will, no documentary evidence that specifically says that Israel ever offered to sell South Africa nuclear weapons. And in fact, even the Guardian newspaper itself says that this is a conclusion that has been drawn from the documents that have recently been declassified. One of the reports did say that Israel did try to stop these reports being declassified, but that may well be for other reasons.
There is, as you say, a heap of documents there. Israel is not denying, is it, that it was selling weapons and maybe missiles to South Africa, just not the nuclear warheads?
That specific question hasn't actually been asked. The denial is over whether South Africa was offered nuclear weapons by Israel. Now, what's happened this morning is that you have obviously had the Israeli media digesting this story, seeking a response, and pretty much no one here accepts the idea that Shimon Peres ever offered nuclear weapons. But that is not to say that there haven't been some people who were around at the time and who were involved in the Israeli defence organisations at the time saying, well, yes, we did produce weapons for South Africa. It's also speculated that South Africa played a part in the development of Israel's ambiguous nuclear program by allowing testing in the Indian Ocean. Now, but the specific question of whether it sold nukes, no one over here seems to accept that story, even from the left.
And that's despite the fact that these are South African cabinet documents.
It is. But look, one of the points that is being made over here today is by a columnist, Akiva Elder, who's kind of a voice in the wilderness. His take on it today is, look, forget about the issue of whether Israel sold or offered to sell nuclear weapons to South Africa or not. Take a look at the rest of the book, and what it shows is some uncomfortable detail about the depth of the relationship between Israel in 1974 and the apartheid regime in South Africa in 1974. He goes into the book and looks at a letter that Shimon Peres wrote to South Africa, having been there on a visit in 1974 as defence minister. Peres used lines like, the cooperation is based not only on common interests, but also on the unshakable foundations of our common hatred of injustice and refusal to submit to it. Now, this is a letter to the apartheid regime in South Africa, and it's the same Shimon Peres who not long ago was dismissing the South African judge Richard Goldstone and his report into Gaza by describing him as a small man devoid of any sense of justice. One of the stories that's been running in Israel over the past couple of weeks has been highlighting Richard Goldstone's service on the bench as a judge in South Africa, passing death sentences or upholding death sentences on black South Africans and being described as a tool of the apartheid regime. So this is going to make pretty uncomfortable reading for Israel, nukes or not.
Thank you very much, Ben. Ben Knight is our Middle East correspondent. An Irish-Australian man is in a Thai jail tonight after he was arrested by police in the roundup after the red shirt demonstrations of the last few weeks. He's Connor David Purcell, who was seen rousing the crowds in fiery speeches from the stage where the red shirts were camped in central Bangkok. Here's part of one of his appearances.
I am Irish and I'm Australian. I was in the Australian Army for 7 years. I would like to ask the Thai soldiers
Do you come from Thai mothers? Do you have Thai sisters? I saw you shoot into Thai mothers, Thai sisters, Thai uncles.
ผมเห็นคุณยิงใส่แม่ที่เป็นคนไทยผมเห็นคุณยิงใส่พี่สาวน้องสาวที่เป็นคนไทยผมเห็นคุณยิงใส่ลุงป้านะ
Were you brave soldiers then?
ที่เป็นคนไทยคุณยังเป็นทหารที่มีความวีระอาหารแบบชายชาติทหารหรือเปล่า
That's Conor David Purcell speaking there at the height of the Red Shirt Revolt. But he's now in a prison in Bangkok, and our Foreign Affairs editor Peter Cave has been at the jail where he's being held. Peter joins me now. So what condition is he in? What's he been charged with?
Well, I managed to get into the remand section of the Klong Prem Central Prison on the outskirts of Bangkok. He looks well. He says that what he was doing for the Red Shirts was acting as a liaison for the military. He said the reason he was doing that, he said he was the only one who was prepared to run through the bullets to act as a liaison with the military. He says he was wounded in the hip doing that. When I asked him about the charges against him, he said as far as he's concerned and from the questioning he's had, the only charge he faces now is a charge of breaking the curfew. That's a charge under the emergency legislation which can bring 2 years jail. That's a little at odds with what the newspapers here are saying and what Australian officials are saying. They say that he may well be charged, he may well face charges of inciting the crowd in that performance that you heard.
It's been said that he's a former Australian Army soldier, maybe served in the SAS, but there are also some doubts about his general life story. What were you able to find out?
Look, my talk with him was interrupted. The guards took him away before I got onto to that part of the story. My understanding is that certainly a large part of that service was as a reservist in the military rather than someone serving as a full-time soldier.
Because there have been some references to his having trained as a sniper, which might make his situation much more difficult now.
Yes, certainly those stories have appeared in Bangkok newspapers this morning with a suggestion that he may well face much more serious charges. There were accusations by the government that snipers were involved in shooting not only police officers but also journalists during the demonstration. He denies that. He says that his only job was to act as a liaison, but he says that he does have evidence of atrocities committed by the troops sent in to move people out of the Red Shirt encampment.
You say that he was taken away before you could find out much more. What happens to him now?
Look, he's due to go to court tomorrow, as I understand it. He will be speaking to Australian consular officials before then. And he, as I said, he says that he expects only to be charged tomorrow with breaking the curfew, which is an offence under the emergency services. More than 500 people have already appeared in court and been given small fines for doing that. He says he's confident that he'll be released on bail tomorrow.
And on a much broader scale, the man who is alleged to have financed and organised the Red Shirts, Thaksin Shinawat, the exiled Prime Minister, he's facing charges as well.
Yes, the criminal court today heard a petition from government prosecutors demanding that he be charged under terrorism laws. That has now gone ahead and the court has issued a warrant for his arrest under terrorism charges. The main import of that is that it will allow the government or give the government more swing in its attempts to have him extradited out of whichever foreign country he happens to be in and brought back to Thailand to face charges. The terrorism charges are indeed quite serious and can carry the death penalty. And indeed, those are the very charges which could presumably be brought against Conor Purcell if they do find any evidence.
Peter Cave, thank you very much. Peter is our Foreign Affairs Editor. Things are getting more and more tense on the Korean Peninsula after a report identified North Korea as having sunk a South Korean Navy ship. The US has now announced that it's starting a joint anti-submarine exercise with South Korea in the near future. North Korea is said to have put its troops on a combat footing. Our North Asia correspondent Mark Willis, he says there's also a range of other indications of how the atmosphere has deteriorated, starting on the South Korean side of the border.
Well, they've started installing loudspeakers along the border with North Korea. Now, these aren't just loudspeakers or noisemakers that you get up the road from a couple of teenagers having a late-night party. These loudspeakers can actually pump noise 20 kilometres across the border into North Korea. And the greatest fear Kim Jong-il has, basically, is that his people can access information. And the South is certain to start pumping information into North Korea when it gets these loudspeakers up and running, talking about basically freedom and democracy in the South. We've already heard that the South has resumed broadcast on an FM radio frequency into the North called Voice of Freedom. It's basically running songs from a South Korean band extolling freedom of choice, and it's also broadcasting comments about how obesity rather than hunger is a problem in the South. So that's obviously something the North Koreans probably don't know too much about.
Is there anything specifically that Kim Jong-il doesn't want to hear broadcast?
There is, and that is sensitive information about himself and his family. Obviously, his people for years have been kept in the dark about what Kim Jong-il does, what his personality is like, who his family members are. They don't even know that the third son has been lined up to be, we understand, the next North Korean leader. All that information is extremely sensitive. Kim's greatest fear, as I've said, is that information will get to his people, and information is power, and it's power that Kim Jong-il does not want his North Korean citizens to have.
And does a reasonable proportion of the North Korean population live within 20 k's of the border?
Not a lot, but there is a significant population there. There is obviously a population gathered on both sides of that border, and it's a population that's sort of been caught like the meat in the sandwich. So there is people down there that Kim Jong-il, obviously as citizens, he doesn't want them to know exactly what his family's up to, and the South, well, they're very keen to tell these people exactly what's going on.
But the danger now is that North Korea has threatened to open fire with its artillery when these things start blasting out the noise.
That's right. Its artillery is well dug in on the northern side of that border. In fact, it could easily hit those loudspeakers. Seoul, it must be remembered, is only 40 or 50 kilometres from the border, and North Korean artillery is well and truly trained on Seoul, so the loudspeakers are no problem at all. And it must be noted that we are getting reports today as well that North Korea has declared a combat alert in response to this warship probe that has been announced and reported by South Korea. We're getting reports that ordinary people are being ordered to get out their army uniforms and to wear army uniforms in the street. Basically, we're told by North Korean sources to raise their spirits. So we understand that North Korea has up their alert readiness, and it's at a stage called combat alert.
And what about the trade restrictions? How hard is that going to hit North Korea?
Well, it is going to hit the North very hard. Basically, if you take one of the measures, and that's banning the North's merchant ships from using South Korean sea lanes, that means those ships will basically face bigger fuel bills from having to take longer routes. Also, the communist state exports a lot of farm products and seafood products to South Korea. That will be kiboshed basically by the South. And we've had some think tanks put an estimate on the value of this trade ban on North Korea, and it will cost the North possibly between a quarter and a third of $1 billion. For a large country like South Korea, that would probably not be much of a blip on the radar, but for an impoverished, isolated state like North Korea, that is a lot of money. And some are saying that will be the thing that hurts Kim Jong-il the most.
North Asia correspondent Mark Willacy, around Australia on ABC Radio, internationally on Radio Australia, and streaming live online from our website. This is PM. The federal opposition is blaming the government's border protection policy for last night's escape of 9 men from the Villawood Detention Centre in Sydney. 3 of the Chinese nationals were caught soon after the breakout, but another 6 are on the run. The government has criticised the private company that runs the detention centre and indicated that it may be fined over the escape. But the opposition says the recent influx of asylum seekers has pushed mainland detention facilities to breaking point. And there'll be more escapes unless policy changes are made. Sarah Garrity reports.
The Immigration Department has harsh words for Serco, the private company contracted to run the detention centre. In a statement, the department says a report last month showed security at the facility was inadequate, and although Serco has increased staffing levels since then, it's clearly not done enough.
An independent investigation will be conducted. The contract the department has in place with the detention services provider allows for sanctions and fines if it's proved escape resulted from lax work practices or incompetence.
It's less than 2 months since three other Chinese detainees escaped from Villawood, but the federal opposition says it's government policy, not Serco, that's to blame. Scott Morrison is the opposition's immigration spokesman.
What this is all about, though, is a system that has been pushed to breaking point. We have had, just in the last 5 months, an increase in the onshore detention population because of the chaos on Christmas Island. There's increased by more than 240%. We had just over 300 people in onshore detention centres at the beginning of this year. We had over 1,100 based on figures just released by the department in the last couple of days. The reason for this increase is because Christmas Island has been full and this government has been transferring people to the mainland now for many, many months.
The Immigration Minister, Chris Evans, was not available for an interview, but a spokesman for the Senator issued this statement.
The government rejects any claims that today's escapes were caused because Villawood is over capacity. This is simply not true. Villawood is currently well under capacity.
The statement also points out that between 2001 and 2002, more than 150 people escaped from immigration detention while the Howard government was in power. Under the Rudd government, fewer than 40 people have escaped. Scott Morrison, the Howard government actually saw a much larger number of breakouts under its government, particularly in 2001, 2002. So how is this any different?
Well, back at that time, there had been a significant surge in boat arrivals, which had led to the increase in the detention population. What the Howard government did about that was they stopped the boats. And that's my point here. If you want to take the pressure off the detention system and the detention network, then you need to stop the boats. That is the reason why our detention centres are filling up. And that is the issue that this government continues to fail to address.
The Immigration Department says the nine escapees had not been transferred from Christmas Island, nor were they asylum seekers who'd arrived by boat. Instead, they were people who'd broken the conditions of their visas. Ian Rintoul from the Refugee Action Coalition says the opposition is trying to score political points by clouding the issue.
Well, I think at the moment the opposition have got a one-line song sheet, and absolutely everything that's to do with detention or otherwise is somehow related to, you know, overcrowding or the ineffectiveness that they claim by the Rudd government about border protection. And that's just, you know, so there's just a constant refrain coming from the opposition, which is not about the actual conditions in detention at all. They're not concerned about the conditions in Villawood or, you know, how people are being treated on Christmas Island.
But the Christmas Island Detention Centre is still struggling with issues of overcrowding, and the Immigration Department is looking for new places to move some of the asylum seekers housed there. That idea received some support today from one of the proposed sites, the Shire of Leonora in Western Australia's Goldfields. The Shire's president is Jeff Carter.
I've had to talk to, you know, people around town. Most people are pretty positive, and I've talked to the Indigenous leaders around town, and most of them are pretty positive as well.
But Scott Morrison says that transferring asylum seekers from Christmas Island is not the answer.
Nothing would surprise me about what this government might do to try and cover over and chase its own tail because of the failure of their own policies. What this government needs to do is stop looking for beds and start stopping the boats.
The opposition is expected to put more pressure on the government over immigration during tomorrow's Senate Estimates Committee.
Sarah Garrity. The nation's commodity forecaster says the forestry sector has faced its biggest decline in forest harvesting in a single year and a 30% drop in tree plantings. ABARE blames the weak demand on the global financial crisis and on Japan's growing preference for wood chips from plantation rather than native forests. The collapse of the company's Timber Corp and Great Southern Plantations has also contributed. Bronwyn Herbert reports.
The federal government's commodity forecaster has done its annual number crunching on the forestry sector, revealing how the industry has fared.
Essentially, it's revealed that 2008-2009 was a very difficult year for the forest industry. We saw the value of forest exports decline by about 5.2%. We saw forest harvest volumes go down by more than 10%. And we also saw investment in terms of plantation establishment decline by over 30% in that year.
Paul Morris is the Deputy Director of ABARE, the Australian Bureau of Agricultural and Resource Economics. He says the biggest factor has been the effect of the global financial crisis on Australia's main timber trading partner, Japan.
With a decline in economic growth, there's a decline in demand for paper in particular and pulp and other wood products, and that has a particular impact on the value of our wood chip exports into overseas markets.
The 30% drop in tree plantings is blamed on the recent collapse of managed investment scheme companies Timbercorp and Great Southern, and Tasmanian-based Forest Enterprises is also in receivership. Dr. Judith Ajani is an economist at the Australian National University who specialises in forestry economics.
We've had, well, now two collapses and one in receivership, and there's no doubt that those collapses is delaying the shifting of the plantation resource onto the market.
Another significant market factor is a pressure for companies to ensure their wood chips don't come from high conservation value forests, a problem Tasmanian timber company Gunns has been struggling with. But this afternoon, Gunns told the Australian Stock Exchange that it's assured Japanese customers that its wood chips won't be coming from high value forests. Gunns has applied for the accreditation, but the Forest Stewardship Council says the process could take several years. Dr. Ajani says the market now expects this type of accreditation.
That pressure to source from plantation resources is complementing what's happening in our resource base, which is a very big shift into the plantation resources. And of course, the Japanese paper industry, it looks to sourcing the best quality resource. And what we're experiencing here are some very powerful forces, both on the shifting resource supply from native forest to plantations, and also being complemented by the quality issues, which of course the Japanese paper industry is keenly interested in, higher quality resources which come from a plantation stock.
But ABARE says despite the dire state of the Japanese economy, not all the chips are down. There are some signs of recovery, with China buying more Australian wood chips, and activity in the Australian housing market is expected to spur on domestic demand for wood products.
Bronwyn Herbert. Police have arrested a 31-year-old circus performer on charges connected with allegedly deliberately spreading HIV/AIDS. Godfrey Zabaroni was extradited from New South Wales to Queensland this afternoon. Health authorities are appealing to women across three states to come forward amid concerns that they might have been deliberately infected. Charlotte Glennie has the story.
Not long ago, 31-year-old Godfrey Zabroni was a star performer on the television show Australia's Got Talent.
It's a yes from me.
Yeah, it's a yes from her.
But his luck appears to have changed. Now he's the subject of what Queensland police and health authorities are calling a national public health issue. Here's the Acting Deputy Commissioner, Cole McCallum.
Detectives from the Gold Coast Criminal Investigation Branch will escort a 31-year-old Sydney man to Queensland in time for his appearance at Southport's Magistrates Court tomorrow. The man has been charged in relation to offences under Section 317 of the Queensland Criminal Code, acts intended to cause grievous bodily harm or transmit serious disease, or alternatively Section 320 of the Criminal Code, grievous bodily harm.
The Australian citizen came to the country from Zimbabwe in 1997. Police say they believe he was HIV positive on arrival. Since then, they say he's worked as an acrobat in a number of circuses throughout the country. Here's Queensland Health's Chief Health Officer, Jeanette Young.
We're aware that this gentleman has HIV, and we understand he's had unprotected sex with quite a number of women across the country. So I'm here today to ask any women who have had unprotected sex with this man to come forward and be tested.
The Acting Deputy Commissioner, Cole McCallum, says one woman has already come forward. The Queensland woman tested positive for HIV late last year.
We received a complaint from a female in relation to her health, and we progressed the investigation through that.
In Queensland, it's believed the man spent most of his time on the Gold Coast. But health authorities are also looking for women in New South Wales and Victoria.
The gentleman concerned has spoken to one of my staff members and gave that staff member 12 names. Unfortunately, he couldn't give enough detail so we could contact those women directly, which of course would be my preference. I would prefer to go out to these women and have that discussion. We're unable to do that, which is why I'm here asking your support today to get the message out there.
But Dr. Young says the man has also travelled to other states and territories.
So I'm not confident about women in this country. I think that the message to get out is that any woman anywhere in the country who has had unprotected sex with this man should go and get themselves tested.
Police say they'll be opposing bail when Godfrey Zabroni appears in the Southport Magistrates Court tomorrow.
Charlotte Glennie. West Australian police say they're relieved by the arrest in Queensland of a murder suspect who left WA while he was supposed to be under surveillance. WA police had been seeking to charge Cameron Mansell with the murder of his millionaire business partner, Craig Puddy. Mr. Puddy was last seen on the 3rd of this month, shortly before he arranged to move to Sydney. David Webber reports.
The arrest came less than 24 hours after police released a CCTV image of Mr. Mansell in Queensland. Detective Inspector Dave Bryson from Major Crime in Perth.
This morning at approximately 5 a.m. at Perth time, Cameron Mansell was arrested in the Paluma National Park, which is approximately 85 kilometres north of Townsville.
Cameron Mansell flew to Adelaide on May the 13th, a matter of hours before an arrest warrant was issued. Mr. Mansell had been under police surveillance since being questioned over the disappearance of his business partner. Police would only say that Mr. Mansell escaped the surveillance net by going into premises that officers couldn't enter. Today, Detective Inspector Bryson denied that losing Mr. Mansell was embarrassing for WA police.
Essentially, this operation's been running since the 3rd of May. Obviously, he's moved across to South Australia, then he moved up the East Coast. We're following numerous leads. As I've said beforehand, we had him spotted in Brisbane earlier during the week. Townsville this week, obviously, our officers focused on the leads that we had there. And it was from those great leads from the public that we managed to make that arrest.
The WA Premier, Colin Barnett, has been critical of the police investigation. This resulted in a curt press release from the Deputy Commissioner. It said the Premier was not aware of legal and operational reasons preventing police from detaining and maintaining surveillance of Mr. Mansell. Today, Mr. Barnett was asked about the apparent waste of resources in having to chase Mr. Mansell across Australia.
Well, perhaps that could have been avoided had he not got away from Western Australia, but that happened. I'm sure the police commissioner will review what happened. Meanwhile, he has been taken into custody and presumably he will be charged and go to trial.
Speaking on ABC Radio in Perth, the police commissioner Carl O'Callaghan said the arrest was a relief for WA police.
Oh, I think it's great news. It's and obviously good news for everyone. People have been following this matter now for quite a long time, and to see that he's back in custody is a great outcome.
Commissioner Carl O'Callaghan said he still couldn't say anything about how Mr. Mansell evaded police in Perth and in Adelaide.
In this particular matter, the surveillance information or what happened can't really be made public for two reasons. One of them is that some of that information will be put to trial. The other thing is, if you talk about how someone might avoid surveillance, then of course you give other people who might want to do that a bit of a clue.
Western Australia's Police Commissioner Carl O'Callaghan, ending David Webber's report. The Royal Commission into Victoria's Black Saturday bushfires is being criticised again after another damning leak to the media. The Herald Sun newspaper claims to have seen a draft submission by Commission lawyers which accuses the former police chief Christine Nixon of deliberately misleading the Commission. Just days earlier, the Sunday Age newspaper obtained information from draft submissions by Commission lawyers. Kelly Lazzaro reports.
The draft submissions by Counsel Assisting the Bushfires Royal Commission, Jack Rush QC, were given to 29 parties involved in the year-long proceeding, and any one of them with an axe to grind or political point to gain could have been responsible for leaking the material to the media. The Victorian Premier, John Brumby, says the leaks undermine the work of the Royal Commission and deny natural justice to individuals named in Counsel Assisting's report.
There's no higher legal body that you can set up than a royal commission. It enjoys special powers and special privileges. And when material's leaked, it's a matter of grave concern. My own view is that there should be an investigation by the commission into these matters.
Victoria's opposition leader Ted Baillieu agrees the leaks should be investigated.
John Brumby's indicated that obviously there are many copies circulating in the government. They've obviously been circulated to other parties. It's up to the commission to establish where they've gone, but it's up to the government to establish that they haven't been leaked by the government.
At least one government MP, the Police and Emergency Services Minister, Bob Cameron, was keen to distance himself from the leak.
This is certainly not from my office, certainly not from the government.
Today's Herald Sun newspaper says it's obtained draft submissions which show Jack Rush QC will accuse former Police Chief Commissioner Christine Nixon of deliberately misleading the Royal Commission. The newspaper claims Jack Rush QC will tell the Commission that Christine Nixon's evidence was incorrect and calculated to mislead, and that her failure to tell the commission that she went out for dinner on Black Saturday was a deliberate omission. The ABC understands Christine Nixon's lawyers are considering defamation action against the newspaper. In a statement this afternoon, Ms. Nixon said,
"The allegations reported in the media today will be strenuously defended in the commission this week. I strongly reject the allegations that I attempted to mislead the commission."
After the leak to the Sunday Age, the chairman of the Bushfires Royal Commission, Bernard Teague, released a statement criticising the leak. Mr. Teague said the submissions of counsel assisting are distributed in advance to all parties with leave to appear to enable them to prepare their own responses, and that this is done on the basis of trust. Lawyer John Agius SC has served as counsel assisting three royal commissions, the most recent being the inquiry into the Oil for Food program. He says royal commission leaks are extremely rare because normally a commissioner is able to make an order prohibiting publication of documents like lawyers' draft submissions.
Those orders were made in previous royal commissions. I don't believe such an order was made by the commissioners sitting on the Bushfire Royal Commission. And I'm not sure that they actually had power to make such an order. I can well understand why they might have assumed that the submissions of counsel assisting would not be leaked or would not be publicised prior to the matter being back before the commission itself.
Why would they assume that?
Well, the usual practice in courts of law when one is dealing with written submissions is that those submissions used only for the purpose of the inquiry, or they're not used otherwise prior to that court dealing with the matter. That's the usual practice. It might have been prudent to include a note to that effect with the documents when they were served, but I don't know whether that happened or not.
The commission will deliver its final report to the Victorian Governor, David de Kretser, on July the 31st.
Kelly Lazzaro. The annual Chelsea Flower Show has long been the essence of Englishness, a fixture of the so-called London season, along with Ascot and the Derby. But in recent years, it's Australia that's provided many of the standout exhibits at the Flower Show. London reporter Rachel Brown.
A string quartet echoes the flourish of its surroundings. Precious rocks lie beside real ones in the jewelled garden. Beefy security guards keep watch over $35 million worth of diamond-encrusted, flower-shaped jewellery. A sign at another garden reads, "Please remove your chews." That'd be the pricey shoe brand Jimmy Choos. Extravagance has returned to this horticulturalist's must-see that's been running since 1913. The show's organisers say the financial chaos of 2009 meant the show struggled to attract sponsors, but they say it's a complete turnaround this year. The Australian entry, Fleming's Nursery, had to abandon its entry last year because of the Black Saturday bushfires. The designer, Scott Wind.
We were nearly ready to start packing containers. I was in Melbourne sourcing materials and lining a lot of things together. Luckily, we hadn't purchased that much. And then the Black Saturday bushfires came through Fleming's Nursery, and along with drought, world economic downturn, it was just too hard.
His team has brought the Australian sunshine to London, perfect for its garden's pool and swim-up bar. The jungle-like leaves of the Strelitzia alba helped create the lushness many Australian gardens are missing due to the drought. There are no mosquitoes at this flower show, but there is a curious beetle. The former drummer, Ringo Starr.
Hey Australia, peace and love, brothers and sisters, and I'm going to look at the flowers.
You come here most years, don't you?
I come here every year I can.
And what's changed about it this year, as far as you can tell?
Well, I've just arrived. First of all, I was attacked by Australian people.
Not a bad thing.
Not a bad thing.
There's a new breed at this year's show. It's a sausage-like pitcher plant, an Nepenthes hybrid, that's been named after the English comedian Bill Bailey in honour of his conservation work.
It's a Ventricosa cingulana, which is half of it is quite a common Filipino Nepenthes, and the other half is a very rare Sumatran one.
I mean, immortalised in plant form. I mean, it doesn't get better than that.
And physicist Professor Stephen Hawking, who wrote A Brief History of Time, has visited a garden named after him, which reflects the passage of time through the evolution of plants. Designer Sue Haywood says it also aims to raise awareness of motor neuron disease, which the professor suffers from.
We've actually put a clock in the garden as well, and the water feature actually comes out of the clock and then flows down a dry stone wall and into a swirling vortex that's an analogy for a black hole, which is really, I suppose, symbolising a diagnosis with a disease where there's no cure.
This year's flower show is bathed in rare sunshine. It wasn't long ago organisers feared the harsh winter frost would deter contenders, but the recent heat has made this show a sellout, with some tickets now fetching up to $350. That's five times their retail price. This is Rachel Brown in London reporting 4pm.
And this evening it was announced that the team from Fleming's Nurseries, the Australian company, had indeed won a gold medal. It's their fourth. Finally, to business and finance with Scott Alley.
Thanks, Mark. Yesterday's suspension of reality about Europe's debt affliction ended abruptly as the market surrendered all of Monday's gains with interest. After opening 1.6% lower, tracking a 126-point fall on the Dow, the local share market kept sliding. By mid-afternoon, it was down 2.2%, with heavy selling in mining and financials. By the close, the All Ords had slumped 2.9%, or 126 points, to 4,286. The ASX 200 shed 130 points, also just under 3%, to 4,265. Shares in Forestry Group Guns plummeted more than 24% to 26.5 cents on reaction to the news it had sold its retail hardware stores in Tasmania to a Woolworths subsidiary for $40 million. Fortescue Metals' price spiral resumed, dropping 7.5% to $3.44. BHP Billiton nosedived 4% to $36.28, while Rio Tinto was down 3.8% to $61.70. Westpac was hammered the worst of the banks, losing 3.9% to $22.26. Flight Centre was one of the few to defy the trend. It closed nearly 3% higher at $16.80 after upgrading its profit guidance. With investors looking to reduce their exposure to exporters tied to European markets, there are also big falls around the region. 3% was carved off the Nikkei, while the Shanghai Composite finished almost 2% lower. In London, the FTSE has plunged more than 2.5% in early trade. There's similar falls on the CAC and on the DAX. The Australian dollar, which had been oscillating through the 82 US cent barrier, took a sustained dive around the market's close, losing nearly 2% against the greenback and the yen. It's around 81.05 US cents. Gold is lower, oil is just under $66 a barrel. And that's all in finance, Mark.
Scott Alley, thank you very much. That's all in tonight's edition of PM. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Don't forget AM in the morning and The World Today at lunchtime. I'm Mark Colvin. Thanks for being with me this evening. Good night.